You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Outback Australia, a perfect location for the intersection of culture, faiths, attitudes and beliefs. And this is the case in Dimitri Kakmi's novel, The Woman in the Well. So, Dimitri, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you very much, David. Thanks for having me.
Central Australia. It's a desert, but it really is, you know, supposedly nothing there. But you've brought all these faiths and things together.
Well, it's simply not true that there's nothing there, is it, David? I mean, one of the points I try to make in the novel that it's the landscape, the land, the earth, is a living organism, a sentient living organism, which is how Indigenous people tend to see it.
And you can actually feel that if you've walked the outback.
Precisely.
It's amazing. But you've brought in the Indigenous culture and the Afghan culture to begin with. There is a real association there that I've often overlooked.
There is. And you know, I was really surprised, David, when the book came out, how many people actually said to me, we had no idea Afghan people had come here. And this is where the camels that are in Central Australia come from. I said, well, yes, exactly. And I guess I've always been aware of it because, as you probably know, I was born in Turkey. And, you know, it's a Muslim culture. So I grew up in the Islamic tradition. So I've been very, very aware of Islam's presence in Australia long before white people, in fact. It's very likely that, you know, far north Aborigines came into contact with Indonesian Muslims before we came here. So there's a deep connection.
And the Afghan cameleers were responsible for transport, more so than a lot of the Europeans, across the desert, across Central Australia.
Precisely. And that's where the GAN, you know, the train, is named after them. Yeah. You know, I actually did the trip recently on the GAN.
Right. Now, but yes, we've got the intersection of, therefore, Indigenous culture and Afghan culture. This brings us to Magnolia Din Olden, who's tasked with transporting seven boys across the desert. Can you flesh out who Magnolia is and what she tells the boys?
So Magnolia is a biracial woman. She's Afghan Aboriginal. And she's hired by a mysterious personage in the book to ferry seven boys from Alice Springs to Maree. And what she thinks is, you know, a normal sort of job that will be done in 2 or 3 days, in fact, turns into a complete another nightmare as some mysterious force begins to pick off the boys one by one. And very slowly, because Magnolia is rather dim in some ways, I think, she begins to realise that, you know, the story is in fact tied in to her own personal history and her own family.
Well, let's sort of start unpacking her own personal history, because there's somebody else that accompanies her.
That's right.
On this journey. Dominique, what's going on there?
Well, as we find out in the book, early on in the book, in fact, Dominique and Magnolia had been teenage lovers who had been separated. They'd been separated for some, you know, 10 or so years when they re-meet as adults. And
well, really, there's psychological trauma in the background there.
With Dominique or with
But given the breakup of that relationship and the reasons for that breakup, how much can we say there?
Let's try and stay away from as much as we can. But most definitely there is. So Magnolia is deeply traumatized by the way she and Dominique separated. But let's not go too far into it because let's let the reader discover that.
Well, the reader discovers it. But there, you know, all the associated expectations and things like that that becomes part of that interplay. And you've got virtually a road journey in, to a certain extent, where these things, again, then have to be addressed, looking over your past and coming to terms with that. But now we have a very interesting challenge here. The boys are Muslim boys.
Exactly.
And all of a sudden, we get this introduction of the Muslim face. But you have a supernatural aspect here. We get the introduction of malevolent forces like jinns.
The jinns.
And ifrits. Mm-hmm. Can you explain their presence, so to speak, in Muslim faith?
Okay. So I was born in Turkey. I'm on a small island in the Aegean Sea. I'm Greek, but I was born in Turkey. And so I lived in a sort of culture, in a society that is partly Greek Orthodox Christian and predominantly Muslim culture. And so my early influences were really Greek mythology on the one hand and Islamic folklore on the other. And both have had a tremendous effect on me, and particularly in my writing. And so I suspect it was inevitable, really, that I would write what I think of as really a Turkish story that I've simply transposed. I'll tell you why I said that in a second, that I've simply transposed onto the Australian landscape, which I've grown to love deeply. So the jinns and the ifrits, which obviously come from Islamic culture, they're actually mentioned in the Quran and in the Hadith. They're an integral part. They are, I guess the simplest way to say it is to say they are really the equivalents of demons and angels in Christianity. But there is a difference, however. There are differences. And one of the things that really intrigued me was when I began to find out more about indigenous cultures here in Australia, I came across the Feather Feet, which I just adore that name. I mean, who doesn't? And I thought, God, you know, there's actually similarities here. We're so busy talking about differences, cultural differences. And when you actually start to dig deep, you actually find so many similarities between Greek and Turk and indigenous and so on and so forth.
Well, here we go, talking to an indigenous gentleman. Anango got him too, the man said. What was that, Jack? Nan looked at him over my head. We got him too. What you call ifrits, we call them feather feet.
Yeah.
So there is that supernatural belief. And feet backwards.
Oh, yes. Well, the ifrits, this is how you know an ifrit. The ifrit's feet are turned backwards. So when they walk, they actually walk away from you. This is how we recognize them on the island. Actually, let me just say something else here, David. We call it the supernatural. And one of the interesting things about traditional cultures and their relationship with the supernatural, so-called, is that, in fact, we often don't see it as such. Where I grew up, it was not uncommon for people to actually, you know, see the god Pan, to come back to the village and say, oh, I just saw, you know, the god Pan was playing his flute under a tree, or that I saw nymphs dancing, or a djinn came and spoke to me. And when I started befriending indigenous Australians, and I used the word supernatural, I remember one guy said, it's supernatural to you, but it's real life to us. And that's how we perceive it as well in Greece and Turkey.
But you've got them occurring in all faiths.
Precisely.
And within indigenous belief. So really, there isn't that much separation between the faiths.
No.
And you can experience going into the outback. But then that leads you then to question faith in and of itself. Long story short, she continued, in Gnosticism, there's a true God. True God who didn't create anything. He or it simply exists. This true God brought forth the substance of all there is in the world. At the same time, portions of the original essence have been projected so far from the source that they've changed. Mm-hmm. I nodded, and Dom continued, these discharges are false gods. They're called aeons. According to Gnostics, the God who created this world is an aeon, a false god. Dom nodded, but he doesn't know it. He thinks he's the real deal. In other words, the Christian God, the Muslim God, the Jewish God, and so on, they're fake.
and in other areas, like with Islam, I challenge some of the notions behind Islam. For instance, there's references to the goddess Alila, who predates Allah. And she was the head goddess, in a sense, in what we now know as Saudi Arabia. She was the one who ruled. And if I remember this correctly, she was either the sister or the wife of Allah before he rose to prominence.
We could be getting onto very dangerous ground and offending a lot of people. But in many ways, you've superimposed the landscape, the Australian landscape over these beliefs in terms of the journey these characters are on.
Yes, I do that precisely because, you know, when I came to Australia, I've been here since 1971, and I never really connected with Australian culture and never really connected with any aspect of it until I went to Central Australia. And just utterly fell in love with the Australian desert, the colour, the light. I mean, once you've been there, you can never forget it. It's like a completely different world. So the book for me is a kind of love story or a love song to the Australian landscape.
Now, another thing you've done in this novel, you jump back in time. And that provides a sort of narrative understanding as you go. What was the point behind?
Well, the first reason I jump back and forth in time in the story is it actually reflects how the mind works, how memory works within your own head. We don't differentiate between past, present, and future. So the story is very much in that regard. And I wanted to create a kind of ambiguity in what Magnolia is telling us. Is she actually to be trusted and relied upon, or is this, in fact, some sort of a mind game that she's playing? I wanted to create an imbalance between the real and the unreal.
And there's that unreality there. Can she be relied on? Another thing you do is you offer fables as the story continues.
Well, that, as you may have picked up, is the book is, in fact, I've got to just admit this, inspired by the Arabian Nights, which is my favorite book. I just adore that book. And I wanted to write something within the Australian landscape and the Australian literary context that actually gives the reader that same sort of sense of exhilaration when you read the Arabian Nights.
But it's a way of storytelling as well and building the fabric. But here, this is where you've got me. You also bring in Percy Bysshe Shelley.
Oh, well,
peace, peace, he is not dead, he doth not sleep. He hath awakened from the dream of life. 'Tis we who, lost in stormy visions, keep with phantoms an unprofitable strife, and in mad trance strike with our spirit's knife invulnerable things.
Well, he's in there because, you know, it's elevated thought. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in a God, but...
But it still touches on the supernatural in Percy
Bysshe Shelley. And in nature as well.
And nature. Mm. So he's finding it in nature. Mm. Your characters are finding it in nature. And the reader will also find it in nature. But the reader's going to have to get the book, The Woman in the Well by Dimitri Kakmi, and find out why they are on this journey across the desert, how it is that these boys are disappearing, and will Magnolia survive towards the end? So, Dimitri, thank you very much for coming in and talking with me
today. David, thank you very much.
And now we're going to my pre-record with Mark Brandy. If I can get it to play. There we go. How does a newly released prisoner integrate back into society? This is just one of the concerns in Mark Brandy's latest novel, Eden. So, Mark, welcome back to 3CR.
Thanks, David. Great to be with you again.
We first meet Tom simply trying to find accommodation. He's newly released from prison. What's available to him is pretty primitive.
Yeah, it's pretty much a halfway house that he goes to in the CBD, just a small room and in bad condition.
Well, it begs the question, how did you know about all of this and what prisoners have to go through?
Yeah, well, that's partly, I think, inspired by some of my professional background when I worked in the justice system and particularly in the corrections portfolio. It's a huge issue, it was back then and still is, with prisoners getting out of jail, not having a lot of supports around them, and then finding that a life of crime beckons in a way. So that's sort of the basis for this story.
Well, yeah, the temptation's there. It's convenient. We steal to simply survive, because what happens to him in that halfway house?
Yeah, well, he actually gets some money stolen from under his mattress. He's got his wallet there with the money he's earned while he's in jail, and that goes missing.
But also then,
he's a very generous character.
Yeah, yeah, he's a good guy. He's a good guy, Tom. Like, there's people he encounters in the street who are begging, and another guy's a big issues seller. And, you know, he's essentially got a good heart. He's had some bad things happen to him and some bad luck, but his moral compass is there.
But also then, we've got this sense of a hidden story behind him, and it comes out in the way he talks. So what were you in for? Does it matter? Something serious then, kind of. Not some rock spider, are you? Accessory to murder for helping out a mate. Must have been some mate. He was. What happened? Shit happened. I mean, it's all this abrupt, curt expression which begs further investigation, and he's hiding his past.
Yeah, yeah, he's certainly very cagey, and that is a product of his past and wanting to keep that under wraps, but also I think the prison experience as well, that you only give information that you are required to give.
And he now needs to find shelter. He's lost all his money. Centrelink simply happens to be now out of the CBD. So there are things that have changed which basically make it even harder to survive. Where does he find shelter?
Yeah, well, while he's in the halfway house, there's a gent who's staying there who suggests to him that if he's going to sleep rough, which is what he's planning to do, that the Melbourne General Cemetery might be a good option. It closes up at night. It's relatively safe. So that's where he heads.
This begs a whole range of questions, because here he meets Cyril and we get these conversations about death, the meaning of life. I'm reminded of the gravedigger in Hamlet and such like taking place. Life can be pretty meaningless at times. We try to give it meaning, trick ourselves into thinking there's some kind of purpose that makes it worthwhile. But the truth is, there's no real sense to life. I start to feel very tired. Camus talks about this stuff. He said there's no meaning of life, or words to that effect, or maybe it was Sartre. Always get those two mixed up. Is that what Seamus warned me about? He lets out a burp. Just stuff I read about. Unlike him, philosophy interests me, I guess. But he's mostly into reading the form guide. But you've got this notion of thinking deeply about death, and they're coming across a whole range of circumstances. I mean, you've got the crypts, you've got the whole cultural background of how people deal with death.
Mm, that's right. I think, you know, the cemetery, I actually live just a couple of streets away from the cemetery, and it is this very unusual sort of liminal space in the urban environment, and it does make you ponder those questions about meaning of life and death. When you know, you see a lot of young people who've died and are buried there, mourners coming to visit their loved ones. And I think Cyril's immersed in that world day in, day out. So that's what drives him to think about those issues.
And there's a practical side to the gravedigger's problem of where do you put the backhoe and all of these sorts of things to keep it out of the eye line of family. But then families dealing with a range, well, the death of a young one, for example, and how they all cope. So on the one hand, you've got Tom trying to find a form of existence and shelter. You've now got philosophical questions about life. And what can you tell us about Cyril? Because Cyril offers Tom some work.
Yeah, Cyril, on the face of it, he seems quite a generous bloke. And he says, you know, you look like you're at a bit of a loose end. You need a bit of help. I can give you some work here, doing a bit of grave digging, a bit of gardening around the place. But Cyril, sort of beneath the surface of what he's saying, there's a hint that there might be something else afoot in the cemetery.
So now we've got Tom with a hidden background and past. Now we've got Cyril with a hidden background and past. And you actually add to the mix, because you make reference to your first novel, Wimmera.
Yes, this book and this story and particularly the character of Tom do have a deep connection to my first book, Wimmera. When I came to write this story, in the first draft, it didn't immediately come to me that there would be that connection. But I put the manuscript away, and about 12 months later picked it up again, and that's when it really crystallised that there was a link to that story. And I think after finishing Wimmera, I did have a feeling of sort of unfinished business too, that it was something I wanted to return to in some way.
Now, I want to talk about this generally because we can't actually give it away. This is the great danger. And listeners and readers should go back and read Wimmera to begin with. But what does it do when you use a novel that you've written previously? How does it add to the landscape of the novel and the characters?
Yeah, well, I can certainly in the writing of it, you have access to this kind of world that you've created and that you have imagined, and this, you know, cast of characters and all this contextual information, which sometimes when you're writing a novel, a standalone, you have to do all that legwork beforehand. But I had access to this world, this vivid world, and that was really, you know, it was a magic experience for me to go back and look at those characters and what happened to them and try to imagine where some of them might be now. And I think that does add layers to the story. It does add a depth to the story that may otherwise not be there.
I mean, it's a bit like the fact that Tom has a background, which we come across, which we alluded to at the beginning of the interview. Cyril has a background, and the reader is left thinking, well, what might this be? And then when you contextualise it even further with that backdrop to Wimmera, things start to come into focus perhaps a little better, but it gives us that whole dimension for what is taking place and adds the depth and fleshes out story in a far greater way. We also find out that there's something happening in the cemetery, another subject we can't go into in too much detail.
It's a delicate dance, this interview, I think so.
Well, we don't. We want the reader to find out for themselves. That's half the fun and joy of reading. And so it's quite fascinating. But here we have a problem because there is criminal activity. I think we can say that. But now we've got Tom, an ex-prisoner, implicated. Now, just to go back and in reference to Wimmera, shall we say, we've got Tom carrying the burden, a sense of guilt from the past. They're playing. He has this recollection of playing cricket. I bowl once more, and the boy cracks the ball over the offside fence. Six and out, I say. The boy smiles. I made 12. Let's see how you go. I walk up to him. He passes me the bat. I take the handle, but he won't let go. He looks hard into my eyes. Why didn't you help me? I shake my head. What do you mean? Why didn't you do anything? Why did you let them hurt me? I pull on the bat, but he still won't let go. He starts to cry. I'm sorry, I say. I didn't know what to do. I'll try to fix things. He shakes his head. It's too late now. There's nothing you can do. I wake suddenly. So here's Tom carrying the guilt of the past, and yet now he's got another burden to worry about. Does he tell what is happening at the cemetery, which would betray the people that have given him work, that have helped him, but he'll have to carry the recriminations of that crime as well. What does he do?
Well, this is the, I guess, the moral dilemma at the heart of this story. He made a promise to someone in his past that he wants to keep. He's made a promise to the people who have given him a job in the cemetery, and ultimately, he has to choose.
And that becomes a very awkward predicament for him. Yeah, and for everyone else. And with a criminal record, he could be implicated as well.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's it. I think he's fearful of going back inside. He didn't have, like many people, he didn't have the most positive experience inside the prison. And he's desperate to stay out of there. He's desperate to build a new life for himself. But I think, like all of us, in a sense, it's a universal story that we carry our past with us, and there are things from our past that we deeply regret. But for Tom, the precarity of his situation just heightens that dilemma, heightens the stakes really for him about the choices that he makes.
Yeah, and because he's got to live with his past, he's got to live with a criminal record, he can't find work, he's dependent on others who may not necessarily be looking after his best interests, even though it appears so.
Mm.
And so it builds, and yeah, the burden of the past is there because of the references you've made to Wimmera. One last question then. The significance of the title Eden?
Yeah, well, Eden, it's a phrase that Cyril uses when he describes the cemetery in the first instance to Tom. I think the line he says is, what brought you to this here Eden? And I think for Cyril, it is an Eden of sorts. It is this place of peace and refuge. It's also a place where he's very much in control of things. So there is the religious connotation, of course, to Eden. I didn't have that front of mind when I wrote the book and when I came up with the title. But, you know, I went to a Catholic school when I went to high school. So I think some of that stayed with me, and some of that exploration of the notion of good and evil definitely stayed with me and is a part of the writing of this book too.
Well, it has a particular irony because this is a place of death, this is a place of grief, and yet a place for renewal and life there as well, if only it remains unsullied. So to find out more about what happens in Eden, you will need to read the book. But I would also recommend that listeners and readers go back and read Wimmera, which will give the full contextualisation. I need to say, Eden stands alone. You don't need to read Wimmera, but it fleshes it out quite remarkably. So I need also to say that it's a Hachette release. So, Mark, thank you very much for talking with me once again.
It was such a pleasure, David. Thank you.